Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rachel Kadish, author of the award-winning novel, The Weight of Ink. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. This was a very difficult week in America. Three separate incidents of insane violence perpetrated against innocent people. In two brutal shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, just 13 hours apart, more than 30 people were murdered. 85 people overall were shot. The El Paso terrorist was motivated by white supremacist ideology, and he wanted to kill anyone who wasn't white. He wrote of being driven by President Trump's rhetoric and actions. Well, actually, he just used President Trump's words. And he massacred 22 people in a Walmart. The Dayton shooter was mentally disturbed. He had prepared kill lists and rape lists before murdering 9 people, including his own sister. And then, a few days later, a crazed gang member went on a brutal stabbing spree in Garden Grove in Santa Ana, California, murdering 4 people. I don't have any reasonable explanation for anybody picking up a weapon and slaughtering civilian human beings he has never met. I have even less of an understanding of the pernicious and insane ideology that claims that it's praiseworthy to murder innocent people of a different color or faith. This is madness of a particularly horrible strain. It has happened many times in history. It is horrific every time it happens. And it is happening with great regularity right here in America. The Jewish concept is that we are all created B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God. Each of us. All of us. No one in his right mind should believe he's been given some sort of authorization to slaughter fellow creatures who are also made in the image of God, as we all are. With all the public murders taking place now, perhaps the most awful part is that we are no longer even mildly surprised when one of these attacks takes place. A couple weeks ago, it was the Gilroy Garlic Festival shooting in California that killed 4 and wounded 12. At the end of May, it was a gunman in Virginia Beach, Virginia, killing 13, wounding 4. In fact, in the first 6 months of this year, 2019, there were 248 mass shootings in America, resulting in 246 people dead and 979 people wounded. In civilian settings, in what is theoretically a peaceful country, the U.S. will approach 500 dead and 2,000 people wounded in 2019. That does not count the dead in the brutal massacre at, say, the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh last fall, or the school shootings perpetrated so regularly over the last couple of years. This trend has morphed a couple of times in ugly ways recently, and it seems to be getting worse. We have now officially been talking about solutions to this horrific problem for a long time without coming to any national consensus. Certainly, we need better mental health coverage in this country. The health insurance companies and the government have been diluting and denying coverage for mental health diagnosis and treatment regularly for years. And there isn't much available to some of the most disturbed folks out there anymore. We can certainly do better at diagnosing, treating, and restraining people whose psychoses lead them to shoot or stab strangers in public places. We must do better. And no, there is no honest, sane reason we don't have better background checks on people who buy guns. Except that there hasn't been the political will to implement very modest steps that might just possibly prevent the next insane person or radicalized white supremacist from shooting up the next high school or Walmart or music or food festival or government building. It feels like we're finally maybe getting to a consensus on this, closing loopholes that are being easily exploited by manufacturers and damaged people and, frankly, criminals. It is little, it is late, but it might be something. I hope and pray that the NRA doesn't just spend lots more money to pervert our damaged political system and stop any forward progress, as the NRA did after Sandy Hook and the massacre of innocents at the Newtown Elementary School. That slaughter was 7 years ago now. One thing should be honestly faced in this latest round of murders. Some very prominent people indeed are still in deep denial over the existence of white supremacy. The repugnant white supremacist ideology, the idea that white people are inherently superior to brown people or black people or yellow people or Jewish people, has been around a long time. One would have thought it had finally and fatally been discredited with the collapse of the most evil regime in all history, Nazi Germany, and the annihilation that the Nazis brought to the world and to their own people. White supremacism has been in America a long time, too. It is vile and wrong. But politicians and media outlets who prefer support from anybody they can get are publicly pretending now that it doesn't exist. They are doing that as I speak this morning, I'm sure. The facts are the facts. In just the past 2 years, since the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, exactly 2 summers ago today, white supremacists in America have committed at least 73 murders. That's according to the highly respected and Jewish-founded organization, the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, started over a century ago in the wake of the lynching of Leo Frank by Ku Klux Klan members in Georgia. Of those 73 murders committed by white supremacists in the past 2 years, 39 of the killings were clearly motivated by hateful racist ideology, the ADL report says. The violence of the Unite the Right rally led to this increase in white supremacist activity. Again, according to the ADL, the report's called 2 years ago, they marched in Charlottesville. Where are they now? The violence on the streets of Charlottesville has kindled two major tracks of white supremacist activity, the ADL says. The first is the rampant dissemination of propaganda designed to promote their views and attract attention. The other more troubling track is a broader series of violent attacks in the 2 years since Unite the Right. Among those attacks, of course, were the murderous shootings at the Parkland High School, the Tree of Life synagogue murders in Pittsburgh, the Poway Chabad shooting, and last Saturday's attack on the Walmart in El Paso. These recent terrorist attacks are part of a 4-year resurgence in white supremacist activity and activism driven by the rise of the alt-right. Of course, 2 years ago, in August 2017, during Charlottesville, President Trump famously said, "There are good people on both sides," talking about the white supremacists and those protesting against them. But those were not good people marching in that rally. The Unite the Right rally drew far-right extremists, you know, terrorists, from at least 39 states. It presented 50 different extreme right movements, groups, and entities. Among the many vile things they did was to march chanting, "Jew will not replace us." They carried guns to the Charlottesville synagogue and intimidated the local congregation there. But that was just the tip of the iceberg. More than a dozen Unite the Right attendees have been convicted and sentenced for crimes related to violence they committed during that rally. Most notably, of course, James Alex Fields Jr. of Ohio, sentenced to 2 life sentences plus 419 years for deliberately driving his car into the crowd of counter-protesters, killing Heather Heyer, injuring many others. Over the last 2 years since Charlottesville, several leaders of that Unite the Right rally have come to lead their own white supremacist groups, Some of them have faced lawsuits and domestic and international travel bans. And so-called American political leaders are now quoted stating there are no white supremacists or that it is simply a valid political philosophy in America. And so-called news outlets and their popular presenters are pretending that white supremacy doesn't exist in America because they claim not to have seen it personally. Enough. The United States of America fought a great and terrible war to destroy fascist regimes based in the ideology of white supremacy. It was called World War II. We had to root out the Nazi infection at a great cost and loss to save the world from that vile contagion. Today, our own native supremacists need to be treated as the diseased infection they are. Anyone who defends them or denies they exist, perhaps because white supremacists vote for the party they like, anybody who does that is a kind of co-conspirator, assisting in fomenting violence against innocents. Just stop it. America has had white supremacists all along, but America was founded to provide liberty, justice, and freedom for everyone of every color, ethnicity, and religious belief. No decent American can ever condone either this white supremacist ideology or its proponents. And if we want to stop the violence that is plaguing our public places, we must start by facing this evil and rooting it out. To play us in this morning, here's a new song by Israeli star Eviatar Banai, scion of a famous Israeli musical family who has become religious. It's about his journey. It's called Rachamim.
מסע של רחמים משירז על גמא ושנה באוניות מסע יעקב בנו ורחל אשתו אליהו הקטן וחנה השכנה חתונה בחמסים בדרך לירושלים בכורה ומאיר נולדו כבר חנות ירקות בשוק יצחק בנם הוא האבא שלי לומד משפטים עם כיפה בכיס יורד לדרום בית משפט השלום בשבע תל אביב עם הליה ניו יורק פגשתי בך, עטופה במאיר, נוצה בשלג, חופה בירושלים, עוצר. רחמים משיר אז יעקב ורחל, אליהו הקטן וחנה שכנה, בחור ומאיר ויצחק אבי, את ואני. שמואל הקטן אין פרט מיותר בדרך לחתונה הגדולה בשבע תל אביב עם הליה ניו יורק עד שפגשתי בך חטופה במעיל אוצר בשלג חופה בירושלים אוצר אוצר חשבתי אבותיי הם בת וליסה ג'וליאט לואיס וג'וני דפ אל תקרא לי ישראל אל תקרא לי בניי כלום מאחוריי מלפניי ומצדדיי אביתר בן רחמים בן אברהם ושרה.
That was Israeli star Eviatar Banai, his song about becoming religious, Rachamim. Our guest this morning, Rachel Kadish, is the award-winning author of a beautiful and challenging historical novel that goes from the Netherlands to England to Portugal and shows just how a woman could have influenced Jewish thought in a meaningful way at a crucial time. It's fascinating and a fun book. Meet Rachel Kadish when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Rachel Kadish is the award-winning author of the novels From a Sealed Room and Tolstoy Lied, a love story, the novella I Was Here, and the wonderful and fascinating brand new book, well, semi-new book, The Weight of Ink, which we're talking about today. Her work has appeared on NPR, The New York Times, lots of other publications. She's won a Jewish Book Award and many other awards for her work. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So, a very natural subject for a novel, a woman secret writer who's an expert in philosophy in the 17th century Portuguese Sephardic Jewish community in Amsterdam. Everybody wants to write about that, don't they?
Right. It was for the first year or so when I was working on it, my agent would ask me what I was writing about, and it's complicated.
Yes. You're not a philosopher, but this digs deeply into some really fascinating questions. Philosophy is, my sister's a philosopher, that does not make you wildly popular immediately. Why this subject now?
Well, in fact, not only am I not a philosopher, I'd never taken a philosophy course in my life, and this whole vocabulary was completely foreign to me. But I feel very strongly that one of the fun things about writing is that it allows me to keep exploring new worlds and new lives that are not my life, and that if I only write about people who are like me or maybe have the same strengths and weaknesses I do, then my writing's going to get very boring, certainly boring to me and probably boring to the reader as well. So I tend to leap into arenas, leap fearlessly and then maybe regret it. In this case, I wanted to write about a woman with something to say, living under rules that forbade her to say it. And in this case, I thought, well, she's going to have a philosophy-shaped brain, which I don't, so I better go do a whole lot of research. So that was possibly the hardest part of all the research, was that I had to learn how to speak that 17th century philosophical language. The reward was I suddenly understood that this was talking about many of the same things that I care about deeply in my own life. I just wasn't using that vocabulary for them. But I think the bigger question of why this subject is that I've been thinking about that Virginia Woolf line in A Room of One's Own, where she says, what would have happened if William, she asks the question, what if William Shakespeare had an equally talented sister? What would have been the fate of that woman? And then Woolf answers her own question. It's quite depressing. She says of that woman, she died young. Alas, she never wrote a word. And you can't argue that that is the most likely fate for a supremely talented woman in the 17th century or 16th century. Everything about the history of that time made it unlikely that a woman would be able to write a play if she had that in her, or compose a symphony, or paint a painting. But I couldn't help shadowboxing that. I couldn't help thinking, what would it take for a woman with a capacious intelligence in that time, not necessarily Shakespeare's literal sister, but a woman with something to say, something to contribute, what would it take for her not to die without writing a word or painting a painting? And so I went looking for a setting in which I could tell a story of a woman who does try to find a way to do this, because I thought for a woman to speak in that time, in a forbidden register, she would have to be a genius at breaking the rules. I thought that could be fun, writing figuring out how someone in that era could break the rules that way. And then I fell in love with this hidden Jewish community.
A fascinating Jewish community, and one that had to break the rules to survive, but also had other rules to. And we'll look at some of those when we come back, talking about a wonderful novel, The Weight of Ink, in just a moment with our guest, Rachel Kadish, here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this summer and fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 7315 North Oracle Road, just north of Ina on the west side of Oracle. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night at 7315 North Oracle Road. Shabbat evening services are at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. Join us for Shabbat at 7315 North Oracle on the west side, just north of Ina, or for all of our classes, services, and events. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school, which is just starting up, our Torah Tikes program, and our rich array of Adult Education Academy classes, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org. That's BEITSIMCHATucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest and fastest growing Jewish community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or a kvel, email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcast. Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So, this is a silly question to ask you. Any upcoming travel?
Well, as a matter of fact, funny you should ask. Yes, you know that I'm always traveling and often leading trips that are essentially Jewish heritage tours. And I am leading such a trip in late October to Thessaloniki in northern Greece, Istanbul, and Sarajevo. After that, I'm going to spend a few days in Israel visiting friends. And after that, I'm going to an extremely interesting international conference called Machar, which for those of your listeners who aren't fluent in Hebrew, is tomorrow, organized on the Montenegrin Riviera in one of the beautiful old towns called Budva. Hmm. There's a series of towns along that coast. It stretched south from, well, actually in Croatia.
There's Split
and Zadar and Dubrovnik. And they were all part of the Venetian Empire when Venice ruled that part of the world. And they built these gorgeous cities. Anyway, the Machar Conference is a gathering of Jews from all over the former Yugoslavia who are now largely in a huge diaspora. Many are in Israel, many are in the US, some are in Canada, some are in England, some are in anywhere, Australia, New Zealand, all over the world. And yet, because of the communal structure of Yugoslavia in the old days when it was one unified country and it was communist and it was run by Tito pretty much single-handedly, there was a central federation of Jewish communities that ran everything and kept an eye on people and limited the amount of like Israeli singing and dancing you can do because it's not really patriotic, also not particularly Jewish, but it's a thing that in most of the world Jewish kids do at Jewish summer camps. Israeli folk songs, Israeli dance, whatever. Anyway, a lot of these people know each other, and whether they're 50 years old or 75 years old, they kind of grew up together. They know each other's children. The community was so small that there was a lot of intermingling at sports events and cultural events, not necessarily religious events, although Belgrade's always had at least one functioning synagogue all through the Tito period and beyond. And some of these other cities, too. I mean, Dubrovnik had a small synagogue. But anyway, a bunch of these Jews, like over 100, are coming together in Budva at the very end of October for a conference called Challenges and Opportunities of Being Jewish in the 21st Century. And they will address it not only from their perspective as natives of the former Yugoslavia, but also as residents of wherever they happen to be living now. And they invited me to give a talk on the sort of explosive rise and unexpected rise in anti-Semitism and the violence of many anti-Semitic incidents around the world and the range of government responses and how governments are either recognizing, solving, minimizing, contributing to, whatever, this problem. And one of the things I would note that's possibly surprising, because we were just talking about some of the North African Jewish communities that have basically upped and transplanted themselves to France. So Morocco is one of the few countries in the world in which there's no uptick in anti-Semitism. It's an Arab country, not a huge Jewish community anymore, but once certainly a very important one. And it's one of the countries in the world where there is not an increase in anti-Semitic incidents. Also, within the former Yugoslavia itself, Bosnia, and particularly its capital of Sarajevo, is widely considered the safest place in Europe to be a Jew. Because the Christians and the Muslims are busy hating each other. Nobody hates the Jews.
Nobody has time.
Right.
Fascinating. Tom, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Customer is ordering food in a kosher restaurant. He asks for the borscht, but the waiter says, "Nah, don't get that. Order something else. Even the flies won't go near the borscht." So the customer says, "Well, what do you recommend?" The waiter says, "Get the chicken soup with matzo balls." And when it comes, the customer assures the waiter, "It's delicious." Guy at the next table hears this conversation between the waiter and the customer ordering the borscht, and when it's his turn, he orders the split pea soup. But the waiter gives him the same story. "Don't order that. Even the flies won't go near it." So this customer, too, asks the waiter to recommend something else. And the waiter says, "Get the barley soup." But when the barley soup arrives, it's terrible, halushus. "Hey, waiter," the customer demands, "why didn't you tell me to order the chicken soup?" "Because," the waiter replies, "you didn't order the borscht." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Now a word of Torah. This week we read the second portion of the book of Devarim, Deuteronomy, the remarkable Sedra of Vayetchanan. Vayetchanan includes truly spectacular texts, the Shema, central statement of God's oneness in the world, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, "Hear, Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one," followed immediately by the Ve'ahavta, the commandment to love God with all our hearts, minds, and strength. As if that were not enough honor for one weekly portion, Vayetchanan also includes the recitation of the Ten Commandments, the Aseret Hadibrot, for the second time in the Torah. You know, if you were to rank Torah portions, you could easily put Vayetchanan near the top in quality of content. After all, a portion that includes the essence of Jewish monotheism, the Shema, and the Ten Commandments, centerpiece of all Western ethics, that's a pretty spectacular weekly parsha by anyone's standards. It's no accident that this powerfully affirming portion is read the week after Tisha B'Av, on Shabbat Nachamu, the Sabbath of Consolation, for we take comfort in our knowledge that morality and holiness ultimately bring justice. So what more can we possibly learn about these most famous texts of our tradition? The Shema itself is really a simple sentence. "Listen, Israel, God is your Lord, God is only one." A straightforward statement, one that should be easy to both understand and accept. Wholeness, holistic oneness. So simple, in fact, anyone can understand and embrace it. Although, of course, simple and true ideas often struggle for acceptance. Still, not a complex concept, oneness. Although in truth, well over 3,000 years since we Jews first articulated the idea that God is one, far less than half the world's population actually believes in the oneness of God. But But it is the text that follows the Shema in Arva et Hanan, the Ve'ahavta, that is more subtle, and in many ways more intriguing. For in that prayer we are commanded to love God. Ve'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha, love the Lord your God with all your mind, soul, and heart. Many things in life can be commanded, but love, it seems to me, is distinctly not one of them. So what does the Torah mean when it says we are commanded to love God? It's a strange idea, but a powerful one. For love is essentially a kind of unconditional way of giving, focusing attention and care on another being. Loving God means paying attention to God, to God's existence in our world, to God's oneness, God's moral code for us. In this case, we express our love of God, our ahava, by demonstrating we have learned how to listen, shma. If we truly listen, we will know that we must act well and ethically. In essence, loving God means that we are obligated to listen to and follow God's mitzvot, to live ethical lives, to do so with energy and commitment. It also means that being good, morally good, is a form of love. Perhaps the purest form of love. May we all find a way to express that love through righteous actions, through mitzvot. And so we too may come to affirm God in our world through love. Our guest this morning, Rachel Kadish, is the award-winning author of The Weight of Ink, a complex but delightful novel with a memorable heroine and a great plot. It's a historical book that speaks directly to what Judaism has become today. Find out how. We'll return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
A 19-year-old yeshiva student was stabbed to death in the West Bank's Gush Etzion Etzion block last week. Dvir Sorek of the Ofra settlement was reported missing a few hours after he said he was coming back from a shopping trip to Jerusalem. His body was later found on a road leading to the Migdal Oz settlement where he attended the yeshiva Machanaim. It is believed that he was killed in a different location and his body moved. Cell phone was found earlier near another Etzion block settlement. The teen was part of the Modern Orthodox Hester program, which combines yeshiva studies and army service. The IDF is treating the murder as a terrorist attack. No Palestinian groups have yet claimed responsibility. Hamas, however, predictably praised the murder as a powerful response to the idea of annexation of the occupied West Bank. Sorek's body was found near the spot where three Israeli teens were kidnapped and murdered in June 2014. That provoked the last Gaza war. Security forces are in pursuit of the lowly terrorist with the purpose of catching him and bringing him to justice, said Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. Sorek was the son of Yoav Sorek, editor of the Shiloach Journal of the Tikva Fund, the grandson of Rabbi Binyamin Herling, who was killed in a terrorist attack in October of 2000. We are heartbroken over the murder last night of Dvir. He was a student beloved by his friends, respected by his teachers, said Rabbi Kenneth Brander, president and Rosh Yeshiva, that is, head of the school of Or Torah Stone, which includes the Machanaim Yeshiva and its network. The loss of this sweet soul and gentle spirit will not deter us from continuing to build the State of Israel through the prism of a love for Israel and a love of all humanity. In happier news, there's yet another really good addition to the remarkable quality and quantity of Jewish and Israeli-themed TV series and films available on streaming services today. Joining Fauda and Shtisel and the marvelous Mrs. Maisel and Srugim are some excellent movies. The latest addition is the true story of how the Mossad hatched an outrageous plan to set up a fake vacation resort on the shoreline in the Muslim African nation of Sudan. It's been turned into a movie on Netflix called Red Sea Diving Resort. The plot is pretty amazing and true. The film's protagonist, Ari Levinson, played by a bearded and long-haired version of actor Chris Evans, you know, Captain America. Anyway, he pitches his idea of how to bring thousands of Ethiopian Jews to Israel from war-torn East Africa. And the Mossad's chief's response is, "So your idea, just to reiterate, is to send a group of Jews to a Muslim country run a fake hotel in order to rescue a group of black Jews who might not be able to survive a 1,000-kilometer walk across the desert to be smuggled out to sea by Israeli Navy SEALs to an Israeli ship. Yep, that was it. And mostly it worked. The tourist hotel covered for the secret refugee smuggling operation being conducted at night. Red Sea Diving Resort is the latest Netflix offering to put the Mossad in the spotlight, as well as showing the Israeli series Mossad 101 and the documentary Inside the Mossad. Netflix also produced the film The Angel, about a double agent working for both Israel and Egypt. And Sacha Baron Cohen soon will be seen playing Ellie Cohen, a.k.a. our man in Damascus, in a six-part series, created by the same director of Red Sea Diving Resort, Gideon Raff. It's all enough to make Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn cancel his Netflix subscription, one suspects, especially given the heroic light these productions generally cast their Israeli operatives in. Red Sea Diving Resort is entertaining, and I recommend it. It doesn't go into the story of Ethiopian Jewish experience in much depth, but the film features well-staged set pieces, ratcheting up the tension as the five Mossad agents try to get thousands of Ethiopians to safety. There's excellent use of the stunning South African scenery standing in for Sudan. Red Sea Diving Resort is in many ways a Jewish version of the movie Argo, and the events it depicts took place about the same time, the late 1970s, before Operations Moses and Solomon brought nearly all the Ethiopian Jews to Israel in the 1980s and early 90s. It's a great story. Find it on Netflix. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rachel Kadish is the extraordinarily talented author of the new book, The Weight of Ink. She has won a host of awards and fellowships and such in her not very long career to date. Author also of the novels From a Sealed Room and Tolstoy Lied, A Love Story, which are about as different from this book as they could be. As well as a novel, I Was Here. We started talking about the Amsterdam Jewish community in the 17th century. That's the golden age of Holland, when Holland has a tremendous navy and colonies all over the world and is extraordinarily wealthy. But the Jews that form the core of that community in which your novel is set are mostly Sephardic refugees who fled the Inquisition, who fled the expulsion. Tell us a little bit about the nature of that community. You had to explore it deeply to be able to reveal it in this way.
Yes. I became fascinated by that community, and I was reading around looking for a setting for these themes that I wanted to explore, and I fell in love with this community. And I started from a point of real ignorance. I didn't know that most of the Jews of Amsterdam were Sephardic, not Ashkenazic, in that time period. I didn't know they were mostly refugees from the Portuguese and Spanish Inquisition. In fact, there were so many Portuguese Jews in Amsterdam that saying someone was Portuguese was a euphemism for saying they were Jewish. Huh. It's like now when people say, she's from New York, which I am. That community, I didn't know they called Amsterdam the New Jerusalem, because it was the only place in Europe at that time when Jews could be openly and safely out as Jews. There were only very few rules that they had to obey. Among them, you know, don't say atheist things, but no one was allowed to, and don't debate religion with non-Jews. And other than that, they were more or less left alone, and it was a thriving community. And as I started reading about them, I was noticing so many similarities to the Holocaust refugees that I grew up among, my grandparents, and my mother was born on the run, and there was something so familiar, even though it's different centuries, about the sense of, we have survived this cataclysm, in this case, the Inquisition, and they were rebuilding, and they were trying to reclaim and re-educate Jews who had been denied a Jewish education. And then I stumbled across, I was reading a wonderful book by Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein called Betraying Spinoza. And I was reading about how this community excommunicated Spinoza. I had no idea. I didn't even know Spinoza was Jewish. I mean, I was starting from absolute ignorance. But I was reading the ferocity of the excommunication ban against him. And up until then, excommunication had been a very mild form of community discipline. It was, you know, you're excommunicated for 2 weeks, say you're sorry, don't do it again. That's what excommunication was. And then along comes Spinoza, who is sounding, frankly, atheist and sounding like he's debating religion with non-Jews. And they excommunicated him with such strong language. You know, the language is God's fury will smoke against him, and it's lifetime ban on Spinoza.
Yeah, pretty serious harem. I mean, they're not messing around.
Yes. Yeah, yes. More than anything, it was unprecedented. And I read that. You know, sometimes you read a really old document and the human emotions are right there, and you could hear, you could read their fear between the lines.
Yeah, absolutely.
The sense that we are, everything is hanging from a thread, right? We, if one of us does the wrong thing, it could all fall apart again.
We could all be burned again. There'll be an auto da fe here in Amsterdam.
Yes,
you can feel the fear. Yeah, absolutely.
And having grown up among refugees, that was familiar to me. And I thought, this is the community I have to write about, and this is the community out of which I want to tell my story of a woman who, despite or among all the societal pressures and all the pressures to keep your mouth shut and keep your head down, she has to speak and find a way to speak.
You know, one of the fascinating things, just to sort of a side light about Spinoza, the reason Spinoza didn't care so much about the excommunication is he was a very successful lens grinder, which was a big deal profession, right? And so he had enough income, he didn't need the Jewish community. Others who were in the same position, like Oriol da Costa, actually returned, let themselves be whipped, all kinds of crazy stuff out of that fear.
And I think also, though, if I'm recalling right, Spinoza waited until after his father died to really step out. And I think, you know, people often, we can want to do all the things we want to do on principle, but sometimes it comes down to, are we going to hurt our loved ones?
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of people that convert to Judaism after one of their parents passes away. Kind of a reverse of that. Tell us a little bit about how Esther evolved for you.
You know, I don't outline in advance. I sort of can't. I feel like for me, the plot is something that comes out of figuring out who my characters are and what pressures they're under. Because if you put different people under the same pressure, you'll have a lot of different outcomes, right? Everyone responds differently. So I had to sort of figure out how she would grow up and how she would begin to feel she was maybe different from the people around her, different from what people wanted her to be. And then when she, so in the book, and I don't think I'm giving away too much of a spoiler here because it happens early on, but she and her brother live in the household of this minor teacher. He's a fictitious rabbi in that community, a blind rabbi. He was blinded in the Inquisition. And because they're orphaned, they go to live in his household, and he goes from the Amsterdam community to London to help, you know, re-educate the Jews of London. He brings them along. Because he's blind, he needs a scribe. And for reasons I won't go into, because, spoilers, the brother is not there to do it. And so Esther, as a young woman who has the necessary languages and education, she has the opportunity to sit and read the books in the rabbi's libraries. And she's, at certain points, she starts realizing that he can't see, because he's blind, he can't see what she's reading. He can't even see what she's writing. And as I was working, I didn't plan any of that in advance. I just started thinking what would be the questions that would be on her mind coming out of this Inquisition refugee background. And I was just writing, thinking about her as a character. Of course, later somebody said to me, well, are Esther's philosophical questions your philosophical questions? And at first I laughed it off. I don't have any philosophical questions. You know, this was back when I was still thinking of philosophy as a very foreign vocabulary. And then I sort of did a double take and said, wait a second. Yeah, actually, they're kind of all my questions. They're the questions that I grew up with, hearing the stories of my grandparents who had survived the Holocaust, and my mother born on the run, and all those, what do you do with all those issues when religion seems to be teaching you to have a different kind of faith that, you know, God will intervene and do good things. So in fact, Esther's questions are mine.
The philosophical questions are really about modernity breaking into kind of the ongoing medieval thinking of the time. But it's much more complicated than that, and you spell them out. It's not easy to write about philosophy, even, well, especially probably for a non-philosopher. Tell us, you know, how did you decide what to say, and how much of this is your own views?
Well, I think it was very important to me that the philosophy not be some abstract embroidery on the story that, you know, you could kind of skip all those parts. It was very important to me that the philosophy had to grow directly out of what Esther was experiencing, and not just in her brain, but in her body, what it felt like for her to grieve, to lose people, to fall in love, to go through London and the plague. I mean, her philosophy shifts after she goes through the plague in London and sees and experiences all of that death and has to bury people, you know, in these mass pits. The philosophy had to be, it needed to not be something separate from the story. It's just a different vocabulary for the emotional issues that she's wrestling with. And once I understood philosophy that way, it became very compelling to me. I think often it's dressed up in this very dry language, which is why people often look at philosophy and see it as very detached from our daily lives. But it's about our daily lives, at least certain kinds of philosophy are. So then I would write those letters that she has burning questions she's got to ask me, because she's trying to understand the world around her. And she would put those questions into this language, and I had to learn that language, the language of 17th century philosophy. And then, of course, because I'm not a philosopher, I had the very good fortune of finding some wonderful, wonderful, very smart people who read those philosophy sections for me and helped me if I was misusing that vocabulary.
I think you caught a lot of it. After struggling through all the philosophy, I don't mean to overemphasize that point, but what was your favorite aspect about it? What was the most interesting of the philosophical ideas that you brought out?
I think and this is partly my character and partly in dialogue with Spinoza, this notion of the force of desire in the universe. You're in a climate where martyrdom is being praised, right? You're supposed to be a glorious martyr who, you know, sings on the way to the pyre and you know, sacrifices yourself. And then, so is there room in that for, I believe what Spinoza referred to as conatus, this sense of self-preservation, desire to live, desire to thrive and flourish. Where does that fit in versus this this theology of martyrdom? You're supposed to just give it all up. And that tension fascinated me. And also, I think I had felt very alienated from philosophy beforehand, you know, with apologies to all philosophers out there, but the vocabulary had felt very desiccated to me. And I had felt like philosophers are the people who look over all our petty little human heads to the far horizon, where that's where the truth is located, and they don't get distracted by individual lives. And as a novelist, the only way I can get towards something like truth is looking exactly at the details of one individual life and trying to get to a larger truth through that. So I thought of them as very opposite ways of thinking, but by the end, I had enormous respect for the vocabulary of philosophy, sort of trying to do a lot of what religion does, but without the parochialism.
So I don't want to make this sound like it's a philosophical treatise. It's a good read, and it's a dramatic story without giving out too much. You know, the challenge is what's going to happen to Esther? You know, how is she going to end up? How did you deal with that? Like, that's a tricky question, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I had no idea for most of the time I was writing the book. Which is what is fun for me about not outlining. I mean, I'm on the edge of my seat, too. the novel opens with these papers being found hidden in a staircase.
In London.
They were hidden there, you know, 350 years earlier in the outskirts of London. And when I wrote that, I had no idea how the papers would have gotten there, because that was not the house in which the papers were written. And so I just thought, well, it'll turn out somehow. And so I was along for the ride. And I, because I'm a stickler for historical research, I was really careful not to put a single thing in there that was not plausible with every single fact I could find. I mean, down to the level of what did a loaf of bread cost in 1665. You can find that stuff out. It's kind of crazy. So I would work within the restrictions and parameters of the history, the actual history. And it was just this sort of delightful journey of discovery. And also, I really wanted the book to have a good plot. I, for all, you know, the sophisticated talk of, you know, philosophy we're having, I also, I wrote this book during a lot of years when my kids were young, and I read a whole lot of middle grade novels and children's books. And you know what? It reminds me of something. I didn't didn't learn in grad school, which is that a story should have a really good plot.
Yes.
And I thought, if I'm going to ask the reader to learn all this history and all this philosophy, there better be a really good payoff. And I wanted the ending of the book to feel like that moment where you're watching the fireworks show and you think, wow, that was something, that must have been the end of the show. That was the finale. But wait, no, there's more, you know. And I wanted there to be that payoff. I mean, it's a long novel and it's a lot of history and it's a lot of philosophy. So, one of the things about writing in dramatic history, I mean, I'm writing through the plague in London, the Great Fire of London. Things happen. And in that time period, life was very tenuous in a lot of ways. So it was a tremendously exciting setting, I thought. For me, I had fun writing.
And without giving anything away, I should note that the a lot of the Portuguese sorority did eventually immigrate, a fair number, to London and formed the basis of the English Jewish community. I feel like we go on a great deal more. It's a wonderful novel, The Weight of Ink. Rachel, where can people go to find out more about you and more about the book?
Well, I have a website, rachelkadish.com. And the book is available. You can go to your local independent bookstore, which is a wonderful thing to do.
And first, you got to find the independent bookstore, and then you got to buy the book.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Rachel Kadish. The book is called The Weight of Ink. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Two Jewish. Our guest will be Professor Jody Magnus, archaeologist, excavator of Chukok Synagogue in the Galilee, author of Masada, From Jewish Revolt to Modern Myth, president of the Archaeological Institute of America, just a great guest. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli singer Eliad, the song Masa, Journey. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Osher mitkarev, etzlacht leitganev, osher lo ozev, umitgale bachoshech, bechol katzvot evel, mishehu mistakel, omer toda lael, al ahavat emet, ech sheat rokedet, gam alev sheli roked itanu. מים רבים לא יחבו את האש שלנו, לא. ואת יחפה, אדמה רועדת, איך אחרי כל השנים הרגשתי שייך, בת מהמדבר כמו סופה נודדת, כשחיפשתי את עצמי מצאתי אותה. רוצה להתמכר לטוב שמתגבר, אם הלב אומר בטח שהוא יודע, תכף נתעורר לניגון אחר, לא צריך יותר, יש עוד מסע שלם, איך שאת רוקדת גם הכוכבים רוקדים איתנו. מים רבים לא יחבו את האש שלנו,
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.